Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is Roy Goldberg. I'm with the law firm of Shepard Mullen, Richter & Hampton. I'm appearing on behalf of the petitioners this morning. The TSA decisions on remand from this court's decision in February 2009 should be vacated because they are arbitrary and capricious in that they ignored a key and crucial piece of evidence that was before the agency and was highly relevant to the task on remand. The figure of 1.8 billion persons screened at U.S. airports in 2000 was contemporaneously reported, it was official, it was authoritative, it was highly material, and unfortunately was entirely ignored by the TSA in its remand decisions and in the SH&E report on which TSA relied. Now, this court in the 2009 decisions instructed the TSA to remove from the cost of ASIF screening fees the cost to screen non-passengers. The TSA went about it doing what it did and decided that there were 28 million there was $28 million spent in 2000 to screen the non-passengers. And a key portion of this finding by SH&E and TSA was that there was only 686 million persons screened in 2000.
Was that really the key?
It was a significant portion.
I thought the key was trying to figure out the ratio of costs that were attributable to non-passengers and passengers, and then secondarily to figure out which would have still remained costs because they were fixed regardless of the number of non-passengers. So the ratio was the key. And to try to figure out the ratio, I gather SH&E went around to a bunch of different airports, talked to different personnel, and came up and basically surveyed, because no one keeps stats. Is that correct? No one. We know the number of passengers, is that correct, because of flight data information?
527 million, that's right.
Okay, so no one keeps stats about non-passengers.
Well, except that we do have a critical statistic that was kept.
That's all guesswork too, right? It's guesswork all the way around as to the number of non-passengers. Isn't that correct?
Not the global figure of how many persons were screened is not guesswork, Your Honor.
Why not?
Because those were the DOT statistics reports.
But those themselves were based on what?
They were based on FAA reports to Congress.
What were those based on?
Those were based on information that the FAA obtained from the airlines that had authority for security screening.
How did they obtain that?
It's not in the record exactly how the airlines did it, but what is referenced by the TSA is the fact that there's a reference by the TSA to this 540-odd page report, the DOT statistics report, which is not all the reports in the record, but for several years the reports are in the record. And what they say is they go back to an Appendix C, and this is in Mr. Clare's brief, and it talks about the quality of the data that's presented in these tables. And Appendix C states that with regard to Table 216, which is the key 1.8 billion figure in these various reports, it states that the federal aviation regulations mandate that passenger screening be performed by each air carrier required to implement an improved security program. The U.S. DOT Federal Aviation Administration monitors the records of passenger screening in accordance with the FAR. So that's what we know was the rubric in place. And
I'm asking more of a, based on your knowledge of the industry, no one has any idea, as I understand it, how many non-passengers were screened in the year 2000. And so one guess is as good as another in terms of how you, in other words, there was no counter you went through like you do at a ticket at a ball game or something. No one has any idea.
Well, again, there's a two-part way I would look at it. First of all, we do have a very good idea as to the total number of persons screened. And as far as the percentage...
I'm still questioning how you know that.
Well, when the FAA reports that figure to Congress, I mean, is it a lie? Is it fiction? These are...
It's based on guess, speculation.
Tell me
if I'm wrong.
Sure. No, I don't believe that at all. I mean,
if someone was keeping track of non-passengers going into airport through security in 2000. Please tell me.
Well, again, there's two different issues. How big was the universe, passengers and non-passengers? That is not guesswork. That's an official authoritative government report year after year, the National Transportation Statistics based on the FAA. Now, moving that aside, then you have the question, what is the percentage? Obviously, our expert came up with 63% were non-passengers. Their expert came up with 39%. Either way, it's a significant portion. And the problem that we have here is that when the SH&E decided on 39%, they didn't apply that to a universe of 1.8 billion persons screened. They ignored that entirely. We also believe they made various other mistakes in incremental cost methodology. But clearly, they
ignored. You have to win on the percentage being wrong. Think.
I don't believe so, Your Honor. Our key point is that there is a pool of 1.8 billion persons screened.
Here's why, because you agree the total figure in terms of costs is 448 million, right?
That is true.
So if the ratio is 61-39, 61 passenger to 39 non-passenger,
right?
That's applied to the 448 million. It doesn't matter what the universe of total screenings was, because you still have a $448 million fixed number to which you're applying the ratio.
Well, there's a 440. We would raise above 28 million. They ended up with a $28 million figure. Our figure would be much higher. Whether you look at it in terms of the ratio or the percentage, we're talking about our expert found that there was $142 million, which was the cost. And that was based on...
That's because of the ratio difference, right?
Primarily the 1.8 billion, actually.
And then some differences about which costs were fixed and which aren't, I suppose.
If we got the 1.8 billion in the record the way it should be and duly considered, whether it's 39% or 63%, we're still going to get a lot more money back.
I disagree with that, okay. I think, but if it's still 39%, then it doesn't matter how many screenings there were, because it's going to be 39% as applied to a fixed number of $448 million.
Well, I think if Your Honor is referring to the incremental cost methodology, a second key point is that we were not given that information. We believe we had a due process right. This is a 104-page report that the TSA relied on. They did not give it to us ahead of time. Had we had it, we could have put expert evidence as to whether or not incremental cost methodology is correct. And certainly, Your Honor, if our figure is 1.8 billion and it's 61 or 63%, that's a billion persons who were screened and they were non-passengers. That has to have an impact on incremental cost methodology. We think we were entitled to have that information presented to the agency and have it fully considered and get a proper record before this court. So the record below, we think, was insufficient for several reasons, one of which is they ignored the 1.8 billion figure. Another reason is because we weren't able to comment on the incremental cost methodology. And we submit that's not just a procedural right. It's part of 706 of the APA, which requires the agency to consider critical information. And also, frankly, it's a due process right. There's been a lot of talk in the briefs about what due process was or wasn't found in the prior case. We think the posture is different here. This court has found these fees are unlawful to some extent. And therefore, we have a due process right to the proper refund. And so you get into the issues, what's a meaningful opportunity to be heard on that issue? We think certainly getting the key document, underlying document, and be able to take a look at it and present our expert evidence on that issue to the agency is the bare minimum of due process. And nothing in the prior case is contrary to that. Finally, Your Honors, just hit upon this issue of jurisdiction. They've claimed, on the one hand, we had all the due process we needed because there's judicial review. On the other hand, they say, but not for fees collected after October 1, 2007. And as in our briefs, we think that that's a non-issue here. We believe this finding was ultra vires as the last time, and there's jurisdiction. Also, that if you read the actual language of the jurisdiction review statute, it's pretty narrow. There's nothing specific as to making a determination of the cost to screen non-passengers. And finally, there's a due process argument that we have here. And we certainly don't believe under Webster and under Ralpho versus Bell, et cetera, that Congress has said that there's no jurisdiction to give relief for unlawful fees when there's a due process issue. I'll save the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
All right. Mr. Clare.
Thank you, Your Honor, and good morning. May it please the Court, I'm Jeffrey Clare. I'm counsel for the federal respondent in this matter. Your Honors, I'd like to begin where Mr. Goldberg began, with the methodology the agency used to determine the costs of screening non-passengers. As the court indicated the last time this case was here, and as Judge Kavanaugh's questions indicated to some extent as well, the agency is operating in a data-poor environment here. There simply were no statistics on a national basis on how many non-passengers were screened in calendar year 2000. So it was up to the agency to construct some models and estimation techniques and so forth to make that determination. And the agency...
And that sorry to interrupt, but the key seems to be this $1.8 billion figure. Was that itself
based on
good data or not?
Well, let me answer that with a two-part answer, Your Honor. First, we would question the premise of Your Honor's question that the number of total screenings was the key factor to be considered here. In the agency's view, and in the agency contractor's view, the first thing you had to determine was how many costs would vary in the first instance with the number of non-passengers screened. The agency's contractor that concluded that for most of the costs at issue here, you had fixed costs that would stay the same regardless of whether you added non-passengers into the mix.
That's true for most, but not all. And my understanding of the argument by petitioner is that if $1.8 billion was the right number, then the ratio would be different than the 61-39 ratio that
That's true, and that would, in the first instance.
So my question stands, which is, was that $1.8 billion figure that was reported year after year to Congress based on what was it based on?
Well, as far as we can ascertain, Your Honor, when you have to go back to before the year or 2000 and the years prior to that. Airline security costs were at that time a responsibility of the aviation industry. And what the FAA had done is it had regulations requiring the industry to establish a security program and to keep some statistics on how that program was operating, and to make reports to the FAA of this statistical information. As far as we can ascertain, the information in the reports cited by petitioner in the $1.8 billion number of total screenings is information provided by the aviation industry itself to the FAA, which in turn prepared reports to Congress. And those reports, which are the primary source documents, they're not in the record, but there are secondary sources that cite to those sources. And that's the secondary reports are what the petitioners rely on. Now, the problem with this aviation industry data is the industry has taken a rather self-serving approach to how this data is reported. When there are things like contract money available, grant money available, when it's important.
So to cut through the fog, you're saying that they inflated the numbers in those reports.
Well, I think I'm saying, Your Honor, that there are liars, damnable liars, and statisticians, and that what happened in this instance is when it was in the aviation industry's interest to show a lot of screening activity, it reported a very large number of screening events. And when it turned out that their fees were going to be assessed on the amount of costs that they had expended, then suddenly the number drops from this sort of $1 billion figure to $300-odd million that they reported to TSA when they were required to report the cost of the screening. So this is data that has been inherently suspect. It has been manipulated by the aviation industry to serve its purposes. And it's really not the sort of data that can be relied on here. Moreover, if you look at what the petitioners submitted, the full body of these reports that petitioners reference contain at several junctures notes on the data sources and the limitations on the data sources they note. For example, at the beginning of the report.
Why shouldn't we just remand for an explanation of the $1.8 billion figure?
Well, you could do that, Your Honor, but the test is really not the test for the before the court is whether the agency's decision really considers the relevant evidence and the relevant factors. And so long as the agency has an expert report that it finds credible, that's sufficient to support the agency's decision. I think what petitioners have tried to do here is to place the government's contractor on trial.
Well, it's really a reasoned explanation argument. And when you're missing an explanation of a figure, even if it is a inflated figure, but a figure that's in an official government report, it becomes harder to say it's a reasoned explanation by the
agency. Your Honor, I take your point, but again, the reports that petitioners have cited themselves note the limitations on this data. Petitioner's own expert in the earlier proceeding produced a figure that was, you know, half the figure that they cite now for the same figure. So their own expert, this is cited, I've cited the court to the declaration of petitioner's expert in the prior proceeding. There you're so that instead of what he concludes is that the percentage of non-passenger screenings was 25% of all screenings, and now 25.7, I believe, in of all total screenings. Now they're claiming over 60%, same expert. So there are a number of things in the record that show you precisely how unreliable this data is. Even as a threshold matter, as a matter of sort of basic research protocols and methodology, the first thing you do when you're talking about data is you examine the provenance of the data, the source of the data. You take some time to consider whether the data is accurate and reliable. And any expert report that doesn't at least discuss where the data comes from, talk about its reliability, talk about problems that might be with the accuracy of the data, is something that's inherently unreliable. The contractor that the government relied on, their report reflects a much different approach. They spell out in considerable detail the methodologies used for arriving at these figures. As to the ratio of passenger and non-passenger screenings, what the contractor did is it first found that while there wasn't national data on this figure, that seven major airports had in fact conducted a survey in the pertinent calendar year where there was hard information on the number of non-passengers screened. And we're not talking about small airports here or inconsequential.
You say hard information, it's not real hard because it's just their speculation, isn't it, about how many people?
No one was
there with a counter as people went through.
Well, there were surveys, contemporaneous surveys at the time, asking how many non-passengers had.
As of 2000?
As of 2000, yeah, yes. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I was wondering if this was done in 2000.
Yes, Your Honor. This is information contemporaneously collected from some major airports. And we're talking
the
about
surveys were based on interviews?
That I don't know.
Or questionnaires with people?
I don't know the specifics of how the information was collected. According to the contractor, this is actual data on the number of individuals who went through the security checkpoint. Now, whether they stood there with a counter,
I still question whether it's, quote, hard data, unquote. But
Your Honor, I apologize for not knowing the answer to this, but the only thing in the reports that are in the record talks about this survey data being contemporaneous and actual measurement of the number of non-passengers who went through the security checkpoint. And in other words, they're not, I don't know the precise way this data was collected, but the report makes clear that this is not simply a model or an estimate or an extrapolation. They had some means of actually counting in the survey. So these surveys, they weren't, again, on a national basis, but they were at some major airports like LAX and San Francisco and Boston and Atlanta. And what the contractor did is it went out and interviewed airport officials at a number of airports, including where these surveys were done, asked people there, people in a position to know how many non-passengers might have gone through the gate, then took that information for these surveyed airports, compared it to the survey results, and used one set of data to sort of verify and check the other set of data, took an average figure between those things, and used that sort of combination of sources and these methods of validating the reliability of the data to come up with a number for the percentage of the total screenings for non-passengers. That is, in the agency's view, a far more reliable measure of one of the important determinants of the non-passenger screening costs. Even if these government reports that petitioners cite were more reliable, and we would very much dispute that, government has a right to pick and choose among experts that it finds credible. Here you have an expert that the GAO, an arm of Congress, had hired. It is the same expert whose results were approved by this court in Southwest One. It has a record of impartial and objective and experience and analysis this area, and you have a report that carefully delineates and documents how it went about resolving the factual questions.
You say that the government has the right to pick and choose among what data you rely on, but you don't have the right to ignore contrary evidence.
That's true, Your Honor, but the agency, first of all, the agency has a right to decide which expert it thinks is more more expert and more experienced. And it also has the right to make determinations about the reliability and probative value of evidence in the court.
That's true, but the agency at least has to explain why. You've spent a considerable amount of time explaining why you don't think these numbers are good, but I didn't see any of that in the remand decision.
Well, there is in the remand decision a statement that it found the data to be cursory or unreliable. The decision is at page, the pertinent section of the decision is at page 468 of the joint appendix. Granted, it could have been a more elaborate explanation, but it is still an explanation that does articulate the agency's thinking that it wasn't a reliable source of data. And it is an explanation that is supported by the entirety of the record before the court. Again, the government's contractor should not be on trial here. It is the government's decision that is at issue, and whether that decision is supported by substantial evidence or otherwise arbitrary and capricious as to a factual matter like the number of non-passengers that were screened. The substantial evidence standard is, as I'm sure the court knows, is such evidence as a reasonable mind would find adequate to support a conclusion. And when you have a detailed finding from a well-recognized expert whose opinions have been validated in subsequent proceedings and an expert selected by other bodies than this agency, that's, we would say, more than sufficient to meet the substantial evidence standard.
Let me ask you about something slightly different.
Yes,
I think that you agree with the airlines that you didn't refund the total amount that even under your calculations would have been refundable, right? I think TSA
agrees that
there's 30 million or so.
I want to put it quite that way, Your Honor. If you take the total amount of excess liability that was collected over the five-year period after the agency has made this determination of how much is excess liability for 1 year, and you compare that to the amount that was actually refunded, in total, there is about a $30 million discrepancy. We would agree with that.
Well, my question is the TSA's accounting for this was kind of very vague and general, and I just wanted to know if there had been any specific industry-wide accounting of what that difference was.
Well, Your Honor, we know internally the various, we've listed in our brief like four or five different kinds of factors that affected why the total refund doesn't equal the total amount of excess liability, and internally because the agency keeps, good accounting records, we can come up with numbers for each of those categories that I've talked about in the brief, the amount that was refunded to an airline prior petitioner that's no longer before the court, the extent to which the initial determination of liability was not industry-wide, was not fully apportioned in the first instance, the extent to which there are carriers who were assigned liability, paid some funds, but are now defunct, and there's no extant carrier to whom a refund could be paid, and so forth. The agency can generate a number for each of those categories. It's not in the record here, and the reason it's not in the record here is you do have some 20-odd individual carriers with individual determinations of their refund. And if there was a problem in any individual's calculation of any individual carrier's refund, then we'd submit it's up to the carriers to come in at this point and say, well, what's wrong? This is what's wrong with our refund calculation. Petitioners simply haven't done that here. They point to the aggregate levels for the industry-wide and say, well, because the liability figure doesn't match the refund figure, there must be some error in there. We're not sure what it is, but there's just got to be something wrong with this picture. As we've explained in our brief, there is, in fact, nothing wrong with this picture. That discrepancy can be accounted for through a number of different factors. Petitioner, in their reply brief, essentially says, well, it's up to the government to explain this matter. But we'd submit that the burden really is on the petitioners. It's their case, and it's their petition for review. If they think there's an error in the agency's decision, it's incumbent upon them to say so with some particularity and specificity. And in particular, if they do have individual refund determinations, if there is something wrong with an individual refund determination, then the petitioners ought to at least tell us, if not the court, what that error might be, and they haven't done so here.
All right.
I'm out of time. Thank you, Your Honor.
How about Mr. Goldberg? All right, why don't you take two?
Thank you, Your Honor. With respect to the issue of the surveys, Your Honor, TSA doesn't have them. We certainly don't have them. We asked for them, and TSA said the surveys, the interviews, whatever it is SH&E did, those are work papers. We didn't review them. We can't give them to you. So this is a data-poor environment that TSA has done of its own making to some extent, and this also goes to our issue as to whether they completely delegated improperly to SH&E not only fact-finding, but frankly, all the decision-making to be done with that information. If they don't see the surveys, how are they know whether the surveys are really any good?
By the way, when people are going through the screening, you have no idea, at least circa 2000, whether they're passengers or non-passengers.
I don't even understand how anyone can
make the threshold determination.
We'd have to see those surveys to know exactly what was going on, and we haven't seen them. We asked for them.
I guess some people would have more bags, but...
But as far as the $1.8 billion figure, that is a knowable figure. And let me address that, first of all, by saying, as I think Judge Brown, I believe, was suggesting, this is post hoc argument of counsel. There is nothing in the record to support not using that figure because it was ignored. It was ignored like the elephant in the room. We don't understand why SH&E wasn't told as part of its job, look at this figure or look at this report if you disagree with it. Tell us why. That wasn't part of it. It was sort of completely put out to the side.
You addressed Mr. Clare's point that your own expert had estimated the percentage at 27.5%. in the earlier round of litigation, and is now estimating it at 63%.
Certainly, Your Honor. I believe he's referring to what our expert said in the first round regarding a GAO report from June of 2000. We didn't have the issue of passenger versus non-passenger. I can't remember exactly what it was being cited for. I know it wasn't 2000 data, because if GAO does a report in June of 2000, they're good, but they're not that good. So that would not, it would have been an apples and oranges situation here. What is a little troubling about the government's position, frankly, is that they're saying that the FAA officials who put out this the information for Table 216, which talks about 1.8 billion persons screened in 2000, how many handguns were seized of that, long guns, explosives, et cetera, it's sort of being accused of gross incompetence or worse. I mean, these are figures that were reported to Congress for a reason. For one thing, you don't know and understand what weapons issue you have if it's not in the context of how many people are being screened. So I don't think it's in the record that these were, made up figures or fiction.
Well, the
figures.
Weapons seized presumably is an accurate number.
I would hope it's accurate.
Because that can be determined, and presumably records were kept on that.
And whether the $1.8 billion is off a little bit here or there, for the government to take the position that it was fiction, it's really accusing really of malfeasance by the government officials at the FAA and then at the DOT, who did these statistics reports, that they're just putting out, as he called, lies, damn lies, and statistics. I don't think that's a fair assumption, and I don't think that's one the court should make. These are professionals. They're government workers, and I don't think it's a fair assumption that they just let this information go without having the proper confidence.
What about the idea that it was just based on industry data at the time, didn't really have the significance it has now, so they dug deeper now to try to figure out what was going on, and they came up with a different figure now based on deeper study?
Well, I still don't see anything in the record that suggested that the FAA, that was the regulatory agency in charge of security at screening, it has a different role now, but at the time there was no TSA, of course. And I find it difficult to believe that they just accepted what the industry gave without any scrutiny, without any care, without any caution, and reported that to Congress.
One last question following up on something Judge Brown asked. Is it on this issue of the $30 million discrepancy? I think Mr. Clare said that it would be up to individual airlines to raise concerns about how the adjustments were made to their figures, and that hasn't been done.
We don't agree, because we asked for documents that may have given light on that, and they refused to give us any of those documents. So what they've said is, based on our theory, yes, $149 million. We've given $19 million. There is an additional $30 million, but trust us, because that is accounted for by underpayments by other carriers, by carriers having offsets, by various other issues that they say, and that's it. Trust us, that's it.
But have you identified any individual petitioner who can say that they were entitled to a greater refund than they got?
As far as the petitioners we represent, we're not aware of a situation where the government did an improper set-off or something like that. All we know is that because of this court's ruling, because of their own expert, there was $30 million extra to be refunded. They couldn't keep it. Remember, we're dealing with an industry standard here. We have the per carrier limit, but we also have the industry limit, overall limit. So they couldn't keep that money. If they weren't going to give it back to the carriers, they had to come up with a reason for it. And all they've given are very high sort of, well, this is sort of explains it without giving us any specifics. And there's no way for us to be able to piece that together. We made a timely request for information. It's in the record. That would have helped us significantly to answer this question. But if they're not going to give us the information, it's very difficult for us. So we think they have the burden in the first instance to comply with this court's order to show that they really have given back all of the money that this court has required them to give back instead of give a few reasons. Thank you.
All right. Thanks.